Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, ending the longest war. The Biden administration announces an unconditional withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan as questions linger about the war and its effects. Then, reopening schools. We discuss the risks and benefits of a nationwide return to in-person classes with U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona. And policing in America. The killing of Dante Wright in Minnesota highlights the urgent need for law enforcement to address the sometimes disproportionate use of force against Black Americans.
When you start to sit down and you get to know people and you start building trust, you can respond better, you can come up with better solutions.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Today, President Biden formally announced the United States would withdraw all its troops from Afghanistan by September 11th, 20 years exactly since the fateful day that led to the U.S. invasion. John Yang begins our coverage.
After nearly 20 years of war, today President Biden set the end date for the U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
He said the United States would still work to fight terrorist activity in the region and ensure the Taliban sticks to its commitments.
But we'll not take our eye off the terrorist threat. We'll reorganize our counterterrorism capabilities and the substantial assets in the region to prevent reemergence of terrorists. We'll hold the Taliban accountable for its commitment not to allow any terrorist to threaten the United States or its allies from Afghan soil.
The announcement was met with international endorsement. The secretaries of state and defense met with NATO allies in Brussels to brief them. Germany's defense minister said the alliance, which has been there from the start, would also likely withdraw its troops later this year.
We have always said, we go in together, we go out together. I am in favor of an orderly withdrawal.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani tweeted his support after a phone call with the U.S. president, adding that Afghanistan's proud security and defense forces are fully capable of defending its people and country. In response, the Taliban threatened to boycott the peace process and resume attacks on foreign troops if the United States stays beyond its original deadline of May 1st. While the Taliban continue attacks throughout the country, the new CIA director, William Burns, said today neither al-Qaeda nor ISIS in Afghanistan have the capacity to carry out heightened attacks.
It is also clear that our ability to keep that threat in Afghanistan in check from either al-Qaeda or ISIS in Afghanistan has benefited greatly from the presence of U.S. and coalition militaries on the ground.
May 1st was the withdrawal date that the United States and the Taliban had agreed on in February 2020 under President Trump, so long as the Taliban talked peace and prevented al-Qaeda from having a safe haven in Afghanistan. Violence has been unrelenting. Nearly 2,000 Afghans have been killed in the first 3 months of the year. Some war-weary Afghans still think U.S. troops are leaving with promises unfulfilled.
The Americans have not fulfilled their responsibility to Afghanistan. Their responsibility is to ensure a strong government, the rule of law, and democracy in Afghanistan.
One issue of major concern? What happens to progress made for women and girls who flourished since escaping the Taliban's austere interpretation of Islam? But today on Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer praised Mr. Biden's decision.
It's time to bring our troops home. America does not need to fight forever wars.
Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said it could lead to increased violence in Afghanistan.
Apparently, we're to help our adversaries ring in the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks by gift wrapping the country and handing it right back to them.
Shortly after setting the schedule for ending America's longest war, President Biden visited Arlington National Cemetery's Section 60, the final resting place for many of the nation's dead from Afghanistan. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
In the day's other news, the former police officer who fatally shot Daunte Wright outside Minneapolis was charged with second-degree manslaughter. Kim Potter resigned yesterday and was arrested this morning. The Wright family's attorney reacted in New York.
In less than a week, the district attorney made the decision that we will charge this officer and the family of Daunte Wright will get to have their day in court. So we say justice for Daunte Wright.
Potter's former boss has said she grabbed her gun by mistake, and the charge against her involves negligence, not intent. She could get up to 10 years in prison. Meanwhile, the trial of former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin continues in the murder of George Floyd. We'll have that story later in the program. The U.S. Capitol police officer who shot and killed a woman during the January assault on the Capitol will not be charged. Federal prosecutors cited insufficient evidence today. The woman, Ashley Babbitt of San Diego, was part of a pro-Trump mob. A scathing new report blames the leadership of the Capitol Police for a raft of failures before January 6th. In widely reported findings, the force's inspector general cites equipment shortages and expired weapons, riot shields that shattered upon impact as police battled hundreds of rioters, and a lack of intelligence tracking and training that left officers unprepared. An advisory panel to the CDC made no decision today on resuming the use of Johnson & Johnson's COVID vaccine. The group asked for more data on rare blood clots and will reconvene in a week or 10 days. At the same time, public health leaders insisted there's plenty of other vaccine to go around.
We have more than enough supply of Pfizer and Moderna vaccines to continue the current pace of vaccinations, meet the president's goal of 200 million shots by his 100th day in office, and continue to reach every adult who wants to be vaccinated by the end of May.
Also today, new federal data show drug overdose deaths began rising again before the pandemic and accelerated once it hit. The CDC said that more than 87,000 Americans died in the year ending in September 2020, mostly from opioids and methamphetamines. That's up 30% from a year earlier. The Biden administration has proposed ending a Trump-era ban on federally funded clinics referring women for abortions. Planned Parenthood and others argued that the ban obstructs access to birth control for low-income women. The Trump rule stays in effect until the new regulation is finalized. Texas Republican Congressman Kevin Brady announced today he is retiring after next year. He served 25 years and once chaired the House Ways and Means Committee. So far, four House Republicans and two Democrats are not seeking re-election. The U.S. Senate today confirmed Gary Gensler to chair the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. He is expected to push tougher regulations for Wall Street, and most Republicans opposed his nomination. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 53 points to close near 33,731. But the Nasdaq fell 138 points, and the S&P 500 lost 17. The digital currency exchange Coinbase made its trading debut. It closed with a market valuation of $86 billion. And Bernie Madoff, who organized the largest fraud in Wall Street's history, died early today. Stephanie Tsai has our report.
The scope of the scam shocked the world.
This is one of the biggest fraud cases ever.
The victims numbered in the tens of thousands. Their losses were recently estimated at between $17 and $20 billion. The man behind the con, financier Bernie Madoff. He rose through the ranks of Wall Street, riding the image of a self-made financial guru, eventually becoming the chairman of the Nasdaq Stock Exchange. The ruse was in full swing in the 1990s. Madoff fabricated profits, attracting new investors while paying bigger returns to old ones, the biggest Ponzi scheme ever. He swindled major charities, universities, and celebrities. As of last year, about three-quarters of the cash, some $14 billion, had been recovered by a court-appointed trustee and returned to victims. Journalist Diana Henriquez, author of Wizard of Lies, told NewsHour's Jeffrey Brown in 2011 how Madoff pulled off such massive deceit.
So you would never doubt your judgment about trusting Madoff, because Madoff made you feel like you were a genius, too. He had that magic. It really is amazing.
But in 2008, his magic was revealed for what it really was, one big lie. His own sons turned him in.
What do you have to say to the public?
In March 2009, he pleaded guilty to securities fraud and other charges and was sentenced to 150 years in prison. Bernie Madoff died today in prison in Butner, North Carolina. He'd been battling the final stages of kidney disease. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Bernie Madoff was 82 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, the Biden administration announces an unconditional withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona discusses a nationwide return to in-person classes. We talk about Republican resistance to the jobs and infrastructure bill with Senator Shelley Moore Capito, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
We return to the president's decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 2021. And for that, we get three views. Retired Lieutenant General Doug Luth served in both the George W. Bush and Obama administrations, focusing on Afghanistan. He also served as U.S. ambassador to NATO during the Obama administration. Annie Forsheimer had a 30-year career in the Foreign Service. She was the Deputy Chief of Mission in Afghanistan from 2017 to 2018 and was Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Afghanistan until 2019. And David Sedney was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Central Asia during the Obama administration. Until recently, he was the President of American University of Afghanistan. And we welcome all three of you to the NewsHour. David Sedney, I am going to start with you. Today we heard President Biden say that the threat against the U.S. over the last 20 years has spread around the world. In his words, it's metastasized, and it just doesn't make sense to keep troops in one country, Afghanistan, at a cost of billions of dollars. What is your response to that?
I think he is dead wrong. The threat from al-Qaeda and from ISIS in Afghanistan has not gone away. The pledges by the Taliban to combat that have been shown by the a recent United Nations report to have been lies. So trusting the Taliban, which is what this administration is doing with the future of American security and counterterrorism, is a very bad idea.
Ambassador Doug Luth, is it the case, as we're hearing David Sedney say, that there's still very much a live threat there from the Taliban, and that pulling out is the wrong thing to do?
But Judy, I don't think anybody claims that al-Qaeda is dead. But al-Qaeda in that region, Afghanistan and Pakistan, is decimated compared to what it was 10 or 20 years ago. And actually, the al-Qaeda franchises elsewhere, so Somalia, Yemen, Syria, parts of Africa, are much more severe threats and much more imminent threats to the United States homeland than the branches in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
So, and on that point, let me turn to you, Annie Forsheimer. This argument that the threat that was so present and so enormous inside Afghanistan has spread around the world. In other words, that the Taliban is weaker than it was. What is your sense of that?
Unfortunately, the Taliban will be emboldened by what has just happened. A conditionless withdrawal with a date is removing the leverage that we've had. And at this point, I don't believe that they have any reason to sit down to negotiations with the Afghan government, nor to fulfill any of the promises that they've made regarding fighting terrorism.
And why do you believe that?
I believe that they can simply look at the calendar and also use the psychology of appearing to have kicked us out of the country the way that the Soviets left, to portray themselves as winners. And Afghans, unfortunately, will have to make their decisions based on the idea that the Taliban could come back to power.
Coming back to you, Ambassador Doug Loot, what about that, this notion, the administration argument that the United States can manage whatever Taliban threat there is from the outside, that we don't need to have boots on the ground?
Judy, I think it's really important here to be crystal clear about who the enemy is. Nobody likes the Taliban, but the Taliban have never threatened or harmed an American outside of Afghanistan. Their goal is to have a voice in the governance of Afghanistan itself. These are Afghan citizens fighting for Afghanistan in their own way. There's no, that does not suggest that they are not repressive, Islamists, and so forth, but they don't threaten America directly. They're distinctly different from Al-Qaeda. Now, the two have linkages, and it's those linkages between Taliban and Al-Qaeda, which have been promised to be broken by the U.S.-Taliban agreement, and which now have to be verified and confirmed and overwatched. But the two are very different.
David Sedney, what about that?
That's unfortunately not at all accurate. The Taliban were the host to Al-Qaeda. The Taliban supported Al-Qaeda. And even though in the agreement that Ambassador Khalilzad signed for the United States over a year ago, the Taliban promised, according to former Secretary of State Pompeo, to break ties with Al-Qaeda, they've not done so. The United States has never had a really good handle on what Al-Qaeda's presence are in the U.S. A few years ago, a number of people in the Obama administration, including General Lute, said the same thing, that Al-Qaeda had been decimated. But 2 years later, the U.S. found a very large Al-Qaeda training camp outside of Kandahar that took us completely by surprise. So any claim that Taliban has, that it doesn't have any ties with Al-Qaeda, is not sympathetic to Al-Qaeda, is not allied with Al-Qaeda, is just plain wrong. And any belief that the Al-Qaeda is decimated, as General Lute has said, is unfortunately just not reliable.
Ambassador Lute?
Judy, if I may. What I said was that Al-Qaeda in this region, Afghanistan and Pakistan, are decimated compared to what they were previously. And I just go back to David. I mean, what's the evidence of an Al-Qaeda transnational terrorist threat? The last one by my record, by my survey of the history, is 2005 in London. So the presence of a few Al-Qaeda fighters doesn't constitute a threat to the American homeland.
Let me come back to you, because I do want to bring you back into the conversation, Annie Forsheimer, and that is about what's going to happen to women inside Afghanistan. I know you were part of a conversation today with a number of women, Afghan women leaders. Tell us about that. How are they reacting? What are their concerns?
Thank you. They're reacting with horror and grave concern. And if I may actually link the two for a moment, Al-Qaeda and ISIS are present in Afghanistan. If there is a civil war, which is the deepest fear of the women that we speak to, in addition to the Taliban taking power, the threat of militias that are arming themselves, people who will defend against the Taliban, could result in a civil war, which provides a power vacuum that ISIS will be more than happy to take advantage of. And I think the women are right to be concerned about this.
Ambassador Lute, how do you respond?
I've got to come in on this. My response is that Afghanistan is already suffering from a civil war, and the women and children of Afghanistan are among the most suffering. Over the last several years, each year has featured 10,000 Afghan civilian casualties to the war that's ongoing today with our troops present. And on top of that 10,000, another 10,000 Afghan security forces have been casualties to the civil war that's going on today. The best outlook for ending that civil war is not with 2,500 additional troops or sustaining 2,500 troops in Afghanistan, but by way of negotiating the end of the civil war between the two primary Afghan parties, the Afghan Taliban and the Afghan government.
Annie Forsheimer, what would the women you're speaking with say to that?
I think they would say that this has not been a civil war. This has been a series of attacks on civilians by Taliban, by the Haqqani network, and by ISIS. it's a civil war would indicate that the people are taking up arms against other people. That's not the case. And yes, it hasn't stopped because there have been international forces. But the idea is to push the Taliban to a real peace negotiation, not to give up our leverage.
Doug Loop.
So first of all, I think Annie and David and I would agree that the war that's happening in Afghanistan today is basically Afghan Taliban versus the Afghan government. By fundamental definition, that is civil war, Afghans fighting Afghans.
Not a government. And,
I'm sorry.
It's not a civil war.
Well, can we settle on, without that term, can we settle on Afghans fighting Afghans?
Well, no, it's government enforcing its laws.
Right.
I'm sorry.
And there's been a lot of problems here, Doug. For example, under your leadership, I helped negotiate a strategic partnership with Afghanistan. We should be keeping the terms of that strategic partnership agreement, not giving priority to an agreement with the Taliban that has failed in every respect. So therefore, I think it's very clear that the United States is losing credibility in Afghanistan and losing credibility around the world. This agreement doesn't make it safer. It makes the world more dangerous to the United States. It makes us weaker and allows our adversaries in China and Russia to claim that the United States is weak and can be outlasted. This is a real strategic loss for the United States.
This is a conversation.
I just simply disagree.
We hear you, and this is a conversation that I know we are going to be continuing, but we thank the three of you, David Sedney, Ambassador Loot, and Annie Forsheimer. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about another podcast, the Science Podcast from Science Magazine, a global science research and news source. On the weekly Science Podcast, you can meet the people behind the science headlines as host Sarah Crespi chats with researchers and science journalists to unravel complex science stories and science policies. You can subscribe at sciencemag.org/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
More than half of public schools around the country are back to full-time in-person classes. But many school districts still are using distance or hybrid learning. And there are many questions ahead about what it will take to reopen more fully in the coming months. Amna Nawaz looks at those questions and more with the nation's top education official.
Judy, the Biden administration wants to expand the map of schools that are fully reopened nationwide. And the president has pledged to address racial and economic inequality in education, which widened during the pandemic. The latest COVID relief bill includes $130 billion for schools to help reach those goals. For a closer look now at these critical issues, we're joined by the Secretary of Education, Miguel Cardona. I want to begin by asking you about vaccines and kids. More than 30 states have now opened up eligibility to kids 16 and older. Some colleges are now requiring students to get the vaccine before they come back to school. Do you support those kinds of requirements?
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to see that we're able to provide more and more vaccines across the country. Ultimately, we know that they're effective and they're helping us reduce spread and ultimately get back to some sense of normalcy. We're working very closely with our partners at CDC to make sure we follow the guidance.
But do you think schools should be requiring vaccinations for kids coming back?
You know, at this point, unless it's a requirement that comes out of CDC, I don't want to jump the gun here. I know they're looking at the issue, and we'll be sure to support the decisions that are made from our health experts, keeping in mind that this is a health pandemic. We know it's an educational emergency, but we're always going to follow the lead of our health experts.
And keeping in mind it is a pandemic, as we speak here, cases are rising in many parts of the country. Do you think that schools could face mass closures again if cases continue to rise?
You know, that's a great question. I think it's really important to know that we are still in the middle of a pandemic. There are so many positive signs that we are able to recover. However, I've seen this before in my time in Connecticut. Once we relax a little bit too much in the community, we see higher numbers of COVID in our schools, not necessarily because they're spreading in schools, but because they're spreading in the community and our students go into their schools. So it's critically important. If we want to keep our schools open, which we need to keep our schools open, we have to make sure we follow those mitigation strategies out in the community as well as in the schools.
Let me ask you about some of the racial and socioeconomic inequities that existed long before the pandemic, but have really been made worse over the last year. We have a related question coming in from a member of our Student Reporting Labs network. This is a question from 17-year-old Janice Aragon. She's a student in Brentwood, New York. Here's Janice's question.
My school is one of the biggest in New York State, with over 5,000 students, many of which are low income and minority. I want to ask, what will you do to help bridge the gap in education quality for disadvantaged communities like mine?
Mr. Secretary, what would you say to Janice?
That's a great question. I'm serving as Secretary of Education to really address those issues. And as Janice pointed out, many of these issues existed long before the pandemic. We need to be bold as we reopen our schools and reimagine learning to make sure that we don't go back to a system that had the same inequities that existed before the pandemic. We have an opportunity now to hit the reset button. The American Rescue Plan provides funds and support and guidance around what practices we should be following. And we need to be bold about addressing inequities that have existed in our system and have been exacerbated by the pandemic.
What kind of specific steps do you think you might take with some of those funds that you just mentioned?
Sure. So ensuring that our students have robust summer learning experiences, ensuring that we have social emotional support for students, because we know if students, especially students who are dealing with the effects of the trauma that we just experienced together as a country, some students, especially in those underserved communities, have experienced it worse. We know the data around Black and brown mortality rates with COVID-19. So when we reopen our schools, making sure that we're providing the social emotional supports, but also ensuring that we're providing the academic enrichment that our students will need. Many of these students had to be looking at a screen for a year. We have to make sure that we have better interventions, that we have smaller class sizes, that we have the academic enrichment and support that our students need, not only this spring and next year, but for years to come, to close whatever gaps were worsened due to the pandemic. Smaller class sizes for those students that need it most. Our students with disabilities need additional support. We know that Zoom learning isn't the same for students that require that one-to-one support or that require hand-over-hand manipulation if they're students that have sensory issues. So there's a lot of work to be done, and I know our educators are up for the challenge.
And we know that Zoom learning has caused a lot of students to fall further behind, which leads to my next question about standardized testing. Your predecessor in the previous administration allowed that standardized testing to be canceled because of the pandemic, right? There were concerns that the data would be flawed, that the disparities to access were just so great. A number of people are asking you to do the same thing this year, to cancel that standardized testing because the data wouldn't be reliable. But you've refused to do so far. Why?
So I think previous secretary was absolutely correct in canceling last year. As a matter of fact, I was one of the first states that applied for that because we knew coming right out, you know, the pandemic happening in March and we weren't prepared. A year has passed. And our learners, when we're talking about addressing achievement disparities, there's some difficult decisions we have to make. And one of them is making sure that we do everything in our power to assess which students have been affected and how much they've been affected so that the policies and the resources that are coming out of the American Rescue Plan can be aimed at those students that need it most. Now, there's no teacher in the country that needs a standardized assessment to tell them how their students are doing. But in order for policymakers and state leaders to make sure that the funding goes to those students that were impacted the most, every bit of data helps. This is not the end all, but it's definitely going to be helpful in order to make good policies and make sure that the resources go to those students who are affected most.
What about gun violence? Can I ask you, as schools open back up, as more students return, are you worried about more mass shootings in schools like the one we just saw in Knoxville?
As a father, it always crosses my mind. You know, I have children in school, and as a former principal, especially during the Sandy Hook massacre, I was a principal maybe 45 minutes away. And of course, it crosses my mind. And it's something that reminds me the important work that we have to do, not only to ensure physical safety of our students, but that emotional safety of our students in our communities. So it does cross my mind. I want to make sure, you know, it's very clear that our schools have adapted to the realities out there, as unfortunate as they are, and they do have safety processes. They have protocols for visitors. And I want to let the audience know that as we reopen schools, the emotional safety of our students is going to be something you're going to be hearing a lot about, but the physical safety of our students is something that, as educators, has been ingrained in how we do business.
Mr. Secretary, at the end of this year, among those people exhausted are teachers. They are stressed. Many of them are leaving their positions or taking early retirement. What can you do from your role to help address teacher burnout?
First and foremost, we have to acknowledge what educators have been doing since last March. I think it was March 11th or March 12th. They went from one way of teaching or serving as a paraeducator or serving as a school counselor to a totally different way the next week. And they did it without missing a beat. Yes, we had to learn together as a country, but it happened from one day to the next, literally. And they've worked twice as hard to try to make it so that they're serving their students in front of them and serving the students on the computer at the same time. I visited schools and I saw that happening across the country. So we have to acknowledge that. We have to make sure that we're taking care of our educators, that they're emotional well-being is also taken into account as we think about reopening schools. We have to make sure, I think in general, that we pay our educators what they should be paid. I think parents recognize, I know they appreciated our teachers before, but they recognize the challenge that it is to serve as an educator. And I think we need to really continue to honor the profession, but be realistic that as we come out of a pandemic, there are supports that they're gonna need to be successful as well.
Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
President Biden has proposed a $2 trillion measure titled the American Jobs Plan to improve the country's infrastructure and take care of other needs. As negotiations on that get underway in Washington, I'm joined by a senator who is deeply involved, ranking member of the Environment and Public Works Committee, Republican Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. Senator, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, you've said it is the American Jobs Plan, and you've said that you're interested in the classic infrastructure part of it, the roads, the bridges. Does that mean you can pretty much accept the $115 billion that this bill would set aside for that?
I think probably. I think what I've been interested in looking at is where the job creation aspects of what we consider traditional infrastructure is. And that is roads and bridges, but it's also broadband now. It's also our wastewater and water, safe drinking water facilities. And so it's broader than just a roads and transportation. 115, I haven't looked at it specifically, but it's probably within the ballpark of where I could probably be supportive of that, yes.
You mentioned increasing access to broadband, but what about the power grid?
Well, I think obviously we saw over that storm that we had, of certainly what happened in Texas, that, and we know in certain instances in California and other states that we have grid problems. We're bleeding a lot of energy off the grid. I think modernization of the grid is something we could look at if we went a little broader in an infrastructure package. It's not something that I think of as a traditionally formulated every five-year infrastructure package that we've done in the past, bipartisan, but I think it's certainly bears looking into, and you know, I would keep an open mind there as well.
There's also money in here, Senator Capito, as you know, for retraining workers who are dislocated in manufacturing, in the energy sector. Also, money for home health care aides. Where do you stand on all that?
This is where we begin to really separate, I think, in our visions of where infrastructure can and should be, and where I think. As a United States, under the unity pledges of the president, I think we're going to fall apart. When we look at workforce development, we have numerous workforce development programs. We have a lot that we funded in COVID. You know, let's deal with those where they should properly be dealt with under labor and other kinds of appropriations. The same thing with home health care. Yeah, I'm a great believer in home health care, but that's not part of what I consider traditional job creating infrastructure packages where we're modernizing, moving people, moving goods, and really modernizing our economy.
And Senator, I'm sure you're familiar, though, with President Biden's arguments around this. He said the nation has always, in his words, evolved to meet the aspirations of the American people and their needs. He said we need to start seeing infrastructure through its effect on ordinary working people in America and what the future working needs are going to be of the American people. What about that?
Well, that's why I think broadband is a part of infrastructure now. I think if we look at what's happened during this pandemic, when we see so many people commuting to work or children learning online or delivery of telehealth, that to me makes the argument that I've been trying to make very vociferously over the last 5 years that we have a great, great digital divide in this country. That to me is an infrastructure gap that needs to be closed. And so I think that we have some like identities on this. He talks about some high-speed rail projects. Those are things I think that's well worth looking into. But let's not go away from where we were able to really, I think, do the job creation, boost the economy, and get a lot of people back to work at the same time, and then have our modernization of our airports, our waterways, more broadband. These are the where I think our core functions should be focused at the moment.
There was some reporting today in Politico that the group of senators who met with President Biden early on back in January, and you were one of them,
yes,
have come away, frankly, feeling that you were burned, that he wasn't really serious about wanting to work with Republicans. Where do you think he stands right now?
Well, I was in the meeting with the group of 10, and the president was very engaged in that meeting and very much pledging to, again, come together in an area that we've had great consensus on, which was COVID relief. But the next day, you know, Leader Schumer is talking about reconciliation, which is a non-starter for all of us Republicans for the most part. So we did feel, I wouldn't say burned, I think lessons learned here. So I think you see a little bit of tiptoeing on our part in terms of how aggressive is the White House actually going to negotiate. And I always thought when you negotiate, you come from two different positions and both people move. That didn't happen. We moved as a group of Republicans. The president never moved and basically left us in the dust.
Let me just finally ask you about how to pay for this, because as you know, the president is saying, let's bring the corporate tax rate back up. President Trump lowered it from 35 to 21%. President Biden is saying, let's get it back up higher. Would you be willing to see any increase in the corporate rate? We know corporations earn something like $2 trillion over the last year.
I voted for the Tax Cut and Jobs Act in 2017, and we got much of the desired results during those years before the pandemic. We had more people in West Virginia working, higher wages, more minorities, more women, younger people working. And so we were on a trajectory, I think, of really fully realizing the effects of those tax cuts. We had over $1 trillion come back into this country that was repatriated because of the lowering of the corporate rate. So I don't want to see us go back to raising taxes to where we're going to stagnate, possibly, the progress that we've made. But the big question is, how do you pay for it? We know the gas tax is a declining resource. So let's look at things like vehicle miles traveled or ways that electric vehicles would pay their fair share for the use of the roads. And so I think we're going to have to get creative here, and I think we can. But I don't want to see us raise taxes on small businesses. I think that's a non-starter for most people.
So you're ruling out any increase in the corporate?
For me, yes. And I think this is another thing. I think that strategically, if this is the direction the president wants to go, put that in his reconciliation package if he has the vote and let that fly. I think that if we could just find a big and robust bipartisan effort here, which we can. I know we can because we're working it through my committee right now. I think it'll give the American people the confidence that it's not broken there. They're on their way to working together like we know they can do.
Senator Shelley Moore Capito, Republican of West Virginia. Senator, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Judy.
The defense team for former police officer Derek Chauvin has been making the case that George Floyd died for reasons other than the actions by Chauvin, and that Chauvin's kneeling on Floyd's body was not the crucial factor. Today, the defense focused on that question with its own expert testimony. Yamiche Alcindor has our report.
I do.
Today, the defense called to the stand Dr. David Fowler, former chief medical examiner of Maryland. The defense expert witness spent much of his testimony directly contradicting earlier testimony from the prosecution's expert witnesses. Fowler testified that George Floyd died of sudden cardiac arrest caused by his underlying conditions. He listed those conditions as heart disease and drug use. He also cited a lack of bruising on Floyd from Chauvin's restraint.
All of his injuries were in areas where the knee was not.
Prosecution expert witnesses have testified that Chauvin's knee restraint directly contributed to Floyd's inability to breathe and his ultimate death. Meanwhile, Fowler also said that carbon monoxide coming from the police vehicle also could have affected Floyd. He suggested an object, possibly drug-related, could be seen in Floyd's mouth and could have also contributed to heart failure.
In the back corner of Mr. Floyd's mouth, you can see what appears to be a white object.
This object right there?
Fowler also said Floyd's speech, heard in video evidence, suggests he was breathing normally. Prosecution expert witnesses have said it's wrong to make that assumption. Instead, they have testified that just because Floyd was talking doesn't mean he was breathing adequately.
How would you classify the manner of death?
So this is one of those cases where you have so many conflicting different manners. The carbon monoxide would usually be classified as an accident, although somebody was holding him there. So some people would say you could elevate that to a homicide. You've got the drugs on board. He's got significant natural disease. He's in a situation where he's been restrained in a very stressful situation. And you put all of those together, it's very difficult to say which of those is the most accurate. So I would fall back to undetermined.
The prosecution cross-examined Fowler, attempting to pick apart his testimony on what exactly caused Floyd to die. One prosecutor also suggested that Fowler's statement on a substance in Floyd's mouth was leading the jury.
So you are not then either telling or suggesting to the jury that the white substance was a pill, are you?
I never said it was a pill. I carefully said that I could see a white structure in his mouth.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor.
As much of the nation's eyes are on the trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis, we return to the debate over defunding the police that George Floyd's death ignited last summer. Special correspondent Charlene Hunter-Galt spoke with current and former law enforcement officers about what reforms they believe are needed to improve relations between police and the communities they serve. It's part of our ongoing series, Race Matters.
Our conversation about solutions is with three veteran police officers. Wanda Gilbert is a retired Miami police officer. She was fired for blowing the whistle on a string of dubious arrests, but was handed a legal victory by a Miami jury that agreed she was unjustly fired. Eric Blake is the chief of police in Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts, a position he's held for 18 years. And Delrish Moss was the police chief of Ferguson, Missouri, appointed 2 years after the police killing of Michael Brown. He's currently a law enforcement captain with the Florida International University Police Department. And thank you all for joining us. There have been all kinds of investigations and studies and even a presidential task force making recommendations aimed at a national reckoning over policing. What's gone wrong?
What's gone wrong is that the community now is asking for accountability. And they're also asking for a redress. And now it's an explosion of really looking into a systemic racism within policing.
There have been so many studies that say this is how we fix things. Why haven't they been fixed?
I think part of the issue is that the priority on diversity training or unconscious bias training or de-escalation hasn't been as important as the standard trainings that everyone's been doing. And that's, you know, there hasn't been accountability in a lot of states. You need law enforcement leaders to consider the issues that are going on in the community with their police officers as important as anything else.
Delbridge Moss, what's your thought about why haven't these studies that have been serious studies about what was going wrong, I mean, why haven't they made a difference?
Well, I think there are a number of issues. We shift as a nation constantly. You know, at one point it was terrorism. Those priorities shift. And as a result of those shifts, we also get kind of variables in what happens. We also need to be looking at consistency because we've got 18,000 police departments across the country. They're not all built the same with regard to training, resources, and even priorities.
We're in the midst of intense, sustained political divisions in the country. And so sometimes even the pushback comes from police unions. How do you even deal with that? How do you respond to that?
I think one of the things that has to be the focus is that unions, they have their responsibility. Their responsibility is to protect their membership and to protect, you know, the people that they are designed to serve. But police chiefs have to remember that your job is to make sure that you're giving the citizenry the best policing that they want. So even when you get pushback from unions, even when there's that political push, you've got to make the tough decisions. You've got to fire people who need to be fired. You've got to have people arrested who need to be arrested, and you've got to make changes where they need to be made.
How do you put that into practice since we've got a situation where Black people are being killed by police at a rate that's much greater than their population? Chief Blake?
You need to hold people accountable. I think leadership across the country needs to spend more time looking at the individual officers that are having complaints against them. And again, police chiefs need to focus on making sure that their police departments are well-trained, not just in defensive tactics or firearms, but in community policing and understanding who their community are and making sure that they are held accountable every single day for what they do.
Wanda Gilbert, let me ask you what you think about the defund idea. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think what has happened with that particular statement of defunding the police is it has gotten caught up in the political ramifications that have been going on in this country for the last 5 years. So, but I think what the real essence of it, and I think that defund has been co-opted for the real meaning is that it really just needs to be real accountability. When you talk about implicit biases, those are not things where they can just be trained and come to one training session for a week and then to go back out. There should be some community involvement. There should be some redress. There should be some follow-up.
Some people are using the narrative of abolish the police. Of course, I'm not a proponent of abolishing the police, but defund the police. In a local community like ours, we went ahead and reached out to the mental health community, the women's support services community, and actually engaged them and said, is the relationship that we have with you what you want? Are we doing a good job? Can we do a better job? Are there things that you want to do that we're doing that you want to take from us? And our personal conversation was, no, we like our relationship. But what I try to get across to my officers is don't be afraid of that narrative. It doesn't mean that people are trying to get rid of you. For years, we've been complaining as police officers that we've gone from being servers and protectors to everything from mental health advocates to homeless advocates to support advocates. So they keep throwing everything on our plate. And we're saying, so now that everything's on our plate and they want to take some stuff off of our plate, we're saying, no, don't take that off of our plate. Well, you can't have it both ways. So, you know, it doesn't mean for my community, it doesn't mean a reduction in personnel. It means help. We need to do this together. We're not going to solve, we're not going to solve these problems by law enforcement.
Captain Moss, let me get your take on defund.
Well, I think that all has really depended on who I've had the conversation with. There are people who are who want outright abolition of police, and there are people who've talked about some of the very things that police chiefs were calling for when we were saying you can't throw the police at every single problem that exists. A homeless situation, you can't throw the police at that when you don't provide services. Mental health, when you don't provide services for people, and they become the police problem, and the only thing we're doing is throwing police at problems. And then we're upset when police don't do it well. That has been an issue. So I think that in that conversation, there is some common ground in terms of where we're trying to get. We've just got to sit down and figure out how to get there.
Wanda Gilbert, what is your big solution at this point? Is there a big one?
Well, I think there is a big solution, and it goes back to police accountability. And one of the big things that I think in this new change is we do not respond to a situation first before you investigate with your gun drawn, because already you have escalated the situation.
And Captain Moss, what in your view is the biggest solution that can address these issues?
Look, when I took over the Ferguson Police Department, one of the first things we did was we went door to door, introducing ourselves to people and talking to them about what their priorities were. And that had a number of effects. But one of the effects was they got to know me, they got to know my staff, and they got to know, we got to know who they were, so that the next time we responded to a place, it wasn't the first time we were meeting someone. I think when you start to sit down and you get to know people and you start building trust, you can respond better, you can come up with better solutions, and you're more legitimate in whatever you find, because people have already built a certain relationship with you.
And finally, are you hopeful that this can be resolved given all of the issues we have right now in this country?
I'm very hopeful that we will solve all of our problems, because I think, you know, the brain trust, the heart, all of that stuff, all of that is there to solve problems. And I think our problems are ever evolving. We've just got to be ready to adjust and adapt, because even with the problems that we're having today, rather than thinking that we're going to get to a destination, we have to realize that the work is continual. And it requires continual change and a continual adjustment to the new realities that exist.
Thank you, Chief Blake.
I'm actually very hopeful. This is my 34th year in law enforcement, and I remember when Rodney King happened. There was riots and there was call for change. And were there any real changes going on? Not really. You know. So now, this past year, with the protests and the change, I mean, we're talking national changes going on. From the White House, not only just the states, from the White House. So I really am hopeful that we get to a better place.
Thank you. Wanda Gilbert?
Yes, I'm very hopeful. And as you can see, it's happened even internationally where the world is changing. And also, too, if you look at our young people, we have to have hope, because what are we going to leave? And we often talk about what we want to leave for our children. We can fix this. And you just have to be honest, open, truthful, and you just can't have a training and say we've gotten rid of implicit biases. They're real. We just have to be real, and I'm very hopeful.
Real and hopeful. Well, thank you all for joining me, Wanda Gilbert, Chief Blake, and Captain Moss. Thank you all for joining us and leaving us with hope.
And thank you, Charlene Hutter-Galt, for such an important conversation, especially at this moment. And on the NewsHour online, join us tomorrow at 7 p.m. Eastern for a live conversation between our Jeffrey Brown and Nomadland author Jessica Bruder, who will answer your questions about her book following the NewsHour broadcast. We hope you will join in on that conversation. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.